Hello, everybody, and good morning to the opening panel, Cosmic Themes of Early Soviet Culture. We've had really amazing, very lively discussions and presentations yesterday, and I'm very excited to start this morning and this day with our presentations and the panel discussion afterwards. I will very briefly introduce the presenters, Robert Byrd, Maria Cechonatskir, and Svetlana Shilohina, before their presentations. And please collect your questions that you might have during their presentations for a panel discussion that we will have with the three presenters afterwards. After the panel discussion, we will open up for hopefully many questions that you will have. And I'm very much looking forward to this morning with you. Robert Byrd is a professor in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literature at the Department of Cinema and Media Studies at the University of Chicago. His primary area of interest is the aesthetic practice and theory of Russian and Soviet modernism. He has published books on Vyacheslav Ivanov and Andrei Tarkovsky, as well as essays on Russian film and video art. He is completing a book manuscript with the title Soul Machine, How Soviet Film Modeled Socialism, which analyzes the uses of scale models in Soviet film in the 1930s, and he argues that socialist realism was a modeling aesthetic. With Christina Kier, he is co-curating Revolutionary Every Day, an exhibition of Soviet graphic art and moving images. It is opening at the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago in September. His next project, Revolutionology, examines intellectual revolution across a variety of media, spaces, and historical moments from 1948 to the present day. Please welcome Robert Byrd for his presentation.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers, the curators of the exhibition, and the organizers of the conference for the invitation to come. And thank you for coming out at this early hour to hear me speak about how to keep communism aloft, labor, energy, and the model cosmos in Soviet cinema. I begin with a quotation from Andrei Platonov's 1937 review of a memoir by the aviator Georgi Baidukov, where Platonov provides a richly speculative picture of Soviet socialism. A symbolic image of the entire modern economy might be a heavy body supported in airspace by the thrust of a propeller. At one and the same time, this image gives a precise picture of the most intense work of the mechanism and of the person of our time. But what kind of person is it who works on a machine in the air, on a machine that pulls behind it all of modern technology? Does the pilot person not have some new features which will later be transferred to the character of the future person? Platonov's symbolic image suggests that Soviet socialism can be kept aloft, defying gravity, at least for the time being, as a precisely calculated interaction of mechanical energy and human labor. But there is, Platonov suggests, the possibility of a different economy, one yet to be defined, let alone achieved, where natural limitations like gravity, entropy, and perhaps even death will not have to be resisted so forcefully, where the flight of socialism will become effortless, free, and final. This would be communism, albeit in a version that owes as much to the cosmism of Nikolai Fyodorov and Alexander Bogdanov as it does to Marx and Lenin. Platonov's cosmist communism has made him into one of the most intriguing and inspiring Soviet writers for our day. But I want to present evidence that this cosmic horizon was also available in mainstream Soviet discourse, and specifically in the Soviet cinema, albeit in softer, less conspicuous forms than in the literal belief in the resurrection of the fathers and the need to populate other planets. In particular, I focus on the scale model, a dialectical mode of representation that informed the Soviets' broad optimism about what we might today call the Anthropocene, an optimism that now seems quaint, if not dangerous, but from which we can still learn. So I begin this part one from mechanics to energetics. In a sense, Marxism is fundamentally cosmist. The most common quotation from Marx in Soviet discourse of the 1930s, really more a paraphrase than a quotation, was that, quote, by transforming nature, man transforms himself. This dialectical understanding of nature was evident in Lenin's program of nationwide electrification in 1920, and it was boosted by the publication in 1925 of Friedrich Engels' Dialectics of Nature. Stalin's transformation of nature, beginning with the first five-year plan in 1928, was expedient, opportunistic, and brutally cynical, especially in its murderous reliance on convict labor. But the five-year plans also allowed cosmist-minded comrades like Platonov to continue to dream of an apocalyptic transubstantiation, or at the very least, a decisive leap into a different state of nature. One of the most authoritative visions of this leap came in August 1931 when Nikolai Bukharin described an impending technological revolution, or, quote, technological re-equipping of the entire land, under the auspices of the five-year plans. In his official report, Bukharin lays the greatest emphasis on the increased production of electricity, the automatization of production, and the acceleration of communications. The old methods of organizing production disappear and are being replaced by the flow method with an automatic workbench, with the automatism of the entire process, with its division into a series of steps coming one after the other as on a cinematic film. This montage, as cinematic as it is industrial, is not merely the Taylorist fantasy of total efficiency, which was popular in the Soviet Union in the 1920s, particularly among the artistic avant-garde. Bukharin was describing a world in which the laws of mechanics would be superseded by those of energetics, that is to say, a unified force field that would defy the existing laws of physics at high levels of energy. This leap into a new state of material being required not only new mechanisms, but also a new relation between consciousness and matter, and a new form of labor. And here the second quotation, the old methods of organizing labor are displaced by the use of psychotechnology, psychotechnika, and the methods of employing the working class, tested in the laboratory, measured and scientifically thought through, with which the possible shortening of the workday and increase of wages are in an extreme degree covered by the heightened intensification of labor, by its unusual concentration, and by the sharp rise of norms of employment. In order to keep communism aloft, in other words, the Soviet Union required not only the convergence of theory and practice in a coordinated intensification of tempos of automatic and human labor, it also required, and here again I quote from Bukharin, the transformation of the USSR into a single cultural whole on the technical basis of a developed communication system, one that must be less verbal, quote, humanitarian in the old sense of this word, and more technological. It sounds almost as if Bukharin was calling for the psychotechnologies of the avant-garde cinema to be realized as an economic and social system. Although one version was published in Pravda, the party leadership's response to Bukharin's 1931 report was uniformly negative. Stalin called it, quote, an empty non-Bolshevik report that is out of touch with real life. Lazar Kaganovich accused Bukharin of, quote, a schematic approach, mechanistic philosophy, and Bogdanovism, Bogdanovshchina. But although Bukharin's presentation betrayed a cosmist tendency towards magical thinking, some of the resources he named for the convergence of theory and practice seem startlingly prosaic, local, and small scale. And I quote, he ends with a long section on what he calls technical museums, technical libraries, exhibitions, repositories of blueprints and diagrams, etc., etc. So if cosmism requires the place of the museum, as the exhibition here is arguing, it also requires operations of miniaturization. Common to all these modes of bridging theory and practice was the scale model, the dialectical object par excellence. Oops. Go back to Platonov here. My second part, the Marxist model. Now, the scale model is already present in this, the quotation from Platonov with which I began my presentation, the image of the economy as an autonomous airborne motor. It is at once a symbolic image that signifies powerfully in the present, an experimental object that initiates the achievement of the future, and a machine for transforming the subjectivities of those who labor on it. Platonov evokes common images from the 1930s of children working on scale models, transforming themselves as they produce new technologies on a small scale. In this photograph from 1939, a smartly dressed boy labors on a model airplane at a workbench with aviation posters pinned behind him. The poster on the right plugs this provincial children's workshop into the centralized discourses of power. The boy is explicitly working to add his own modest project to the already assembled ranks of aircraft, fashioning it as an object that will ultimately be beheld by the adoring masses and by the elevating gaze of Stalin and Voroshilov. As in Platonov's image, this boy's scale model exhibits categorical fluidity. It begins life as a toy. It becomes a prototype. And potentially will end up as a museum exhibit about the genesis of a new invention or possibly a new inventor. Through the model, hands teach heads, which then, having become more intelligent, teach hands. The Soviet fascination with models had deep roots in Marxist thought. In the very same passage of Capital that speaks about the mutual transformation of human and natural world, Marx highlights something akin to modeling as the distinguishing feature of human labor. What distinguishes the worst architect from the best of bees, Marx writes, is this, that the architect raises his structure in the imagination, in his imagination, before he erects it in reality. At the end of every labor process, we get a result that already existed in the imagination of the laborer at its commencement. This passage also became very popular in the Soviet Union. In a 1925 analysis, the young Soviet psychologist Lev Vygotsky explicitly and influentially identified this kind of labor as modeling, defined by what Marx is describing here or showing as the doubling of experience. But the Soviet theory of model labor in the 1930s owes its most direct debt to the constructivists, beginning with Tatlin's model for a monument to the Third International, which encoded cosmist ideas on an anthropometric scale, evidently directed less at full-scale production than at the stimulation of further generations of models. Model theory was the particular province of constructivist theorist Nikolai Čužák, who wrote in the first issue of the avant-garde magazine Lev, accepting the auxiliary status of cognition, the working class is everywhere, both in real, actual science and in real, actual art making, and in real, talent-to-talent battle for the needed social structure, Everywhere, the proletariat is shifting the center of gravity from the moment of cognition to the direct construction of the thing, including the idea, but only as a specific engineerial model. Modeling was emphasized as an activity in the avant-garde curriculum of the artistic technical workshops, the higher artistic technical workshops, or Futimas, where designers modeled functional furniture under the instruction of Alexander Rodchenko and Varvara Stepanova, and where student architects were asked to produce material three-dimensional models of abstract concepts like space and volume. For Čužak, the model is an inevitable mode of production for a materialist society oriented towards the future realization of its scientific ideas. The construction of dialectical models of tomorrow, Čužak writes, whether predominantly from an emotional angle, art, or a logical one, science, is just as necessary for the class of the future as the construction of the object itself. And scientifically, both kinds of creativity are equally justified by dialectical materialism. It is not difficult to see, Čužak concludes, that the art of communist constructions will lean increasingly to the model. Čužak was right. The model quickly spread from the studios and workshops of the avant-garde to vocational classrooms and clubs. Under the first five-year plan, the model ceased to be the exclusive province of the radical avant-garde, and by 1932, it became a signal mode of aesthetic production and materialist iconography under socialist realism. My slide is out of order here. Here we go. Bukharin's philosophical arguments in favor of scale modeling, both in theory and as a material practice, were gratefully noted by the authors of a 1932 book, The Art of Modeling, D. Grezer and V. Bibikov, who underscore the dynamism of the model as an ontological category as it passes from experimental object to production prototype and to study device. Grezer and Bibikov argue that far from being merely a modest element in pedagogical practice, the model challenges the most basic notions of Soviet production and labor. Requiring individual initiative, the model cannot be planned. Requiring handicraft and intuition, it cannot be mass-produced. Once produced, it cannot be commodified, since it is immediately superseded by ever new models. Its singularity and categorical fluidity make the Soviet model distinct from mere replicas. The USSR of the Reconstruction period, they write, cannot allow itself the luxury of building dead models. We need living models, which awaken initiative and teach how to build. The model then not only makes representations of the future into concrete steps towards achieving this future, but it also initiates the transformation of labor into a new psychotechnological process. Models then are machines that continually keep communism aloft. Now my third section, model constructivism, model cinema. In the 1930s, set-scale models proliferated in Soviet sound cinema, fulfilling a wide range of forms and functions. Zygaverthov's 1930 Symphony of the Donbass features a working model of the five-year plan, which recalls the Futimas models of abstract constructive principles. A central scene in Nikolai Eck's 1931 Ticket to Life, Putyovka v Zhizn, shows a commune of juvenile delinquents being converted to collective labor by working with a model railway, emphasizing the model's role as a machine for remaking the Soviet subject. The 1932 film, Who Will I Be? Kim Buit, produced by a star-studded crew of former constructivists, Alexander Rodchenko, Vitaly Zhemchuzhny, Osip Brik, composer Arseniy Avramov, demonstrated the fluid interchange between playing with scale models and labor on a full-size apparatus, asserting the non-fetishized object of socialist production. In putting the handmade, miniaturized model to work for the entire Soviet state, these films defy any firm distinction between documentary and fiction, history and fantasy. These films help Soviet cinema live up to Bukharin's expectations, stated in 1931, both for the establishment of a nationwide system of ideological communication and for the replacement of purely humanitarian discourse with psychotechnology, as he put it. Soviet cinema becomes a soul machine. The ability of Soviet cinema to function as what I am calling a soul machine is at issue in the 1934 film One Stop to the Moon, Na Luno's Peresadka, directed by Nikolai Lebedev to a screenplay by Leonid Panteleev. Kolkhoz whiz kid Leonid Glebov begins by building a model of a spaceship named the Earth-Moon Nonstop Express in an abandoned windmill. That's on the left here. Together with classmates, he manages to shoot it out of the windmill, but it crashes in a nearby field, where it is discovered by the head of the local political section, who identifies the culprit thanks to a note from Leonia addressed to Comrade Lunatics. Summoning Leonia to his office, the political boss instructs the boy to approach things more gradually, to begin with paper airplanes, with a view to learning eventually to construct a glider before proceeding to full-blown airplanes. So the group of students reconvenes to build the glider, encouraged by Natasha, a woman pilot from Moscow. After crashing, Leonia recovers from his injuries just in time to take the glider to a nationwide contest in Koktebel at Natasha's invitation. The film establishes not only a conceptual dialectic between play and labor, toy and technology, but also a visual relay between the children and the sources of power, of central power. Here we see Leonia deriving inspiration from Stalin as he constructs a model. As they make their glider, the children look like Tatlin and his collaborators in their model workshop, surrounded by slogans based on Voroshilov's 1933 order in support of modeling. From the model to the glider, from the glider to the airplane, Voroshilov said. And we see those slogans here on the wall of the windmill. Thus, although the film counsels patience and caution, and though as a silent film in 1934 it demonstrates the lag of Soviet technology behind its ambitions, the technologies of flight and of representation present themselves as dialectical steps towards these cosmic ambitions. Fated as a departing hero, as he leaves the kolkhoz for Koktebel, Leonia proclaims, in one or two five-year plans, I will fly to the moon after all. Section 4, the cine model. The role of cinema is not only to broadcast model thinking and model making to far-flung populations, it also participates directly in modeling the new world that it is propagandizing, most directly through the miniaturized sets that allow for special effects. Special effects based on scale models make possible moving photographic documentation of worlds that have never and could never have existed. In 1934, the theorist Kornili Zelinsky, also a former constructivist, drew a direct analogy between models of experimental technologies and the functioning of the cinema under socialism. Naming three prominent inventions from his time, Zelinsky appeals for a cinema capable of showing, quote, how will our transport look if Yarmolchuk's idea of a spherical train and sphere-mobile wins out? Or Waldner's idea of the high-speed train, or Mitürich's caterpillar mover. Zielinski then describes the task of socialist realist cinema as one of providing a cine model of our immediate future, an attempt to bring closer the look of communism to our eyes with the telescope of art. The film that responded most emphatically to Zielinski's call for a cine model of our immediate future was The Cosmic Voyage. Set in the immediate future of 1946, The Cosmic Voyage narrates the first manned mission to the moon by a venerable academic with similarities to rocket scientist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who in fact consulted on the film's design and who approved its screenplay before his death in the year of the film's release. Though The Cosmic Voyage was billed as a sound film, the soundtrack is wholly musical, and the actors follow conventions of silent cinema. And yet, despite this stylistic archaism, the film exhibits several features that make it into a powerful cine model, not only for the immediate future, but also for future cinema. Most notably, the film's spaceships, pictured here, bear distinct similarity to two of the experimental technologies that Zelinsky cites as analogies for his cine models. Yarmolchuk's idea of a spherical train, and there we see Yarmolchuk on the left, and Waldner's idea of a high-speed train on the right. As featured in the newsreel Science and Technology, Nauka i Technika, Nikolai Yarmolchuk developed a series of projects for a train on convex wheels running along a concave channel. In this newsreel, Yarmolchuk displays a 1/5 size scale model of his train glistening in the sun. Around the same time, Sebastian Waldner projected a monorail aerotrain driven by propellers, and a 1/10 scale model of this was exhibited at Gorky Park between 1933 and 1936. Here it comes around the bend. Like these real experimental vehicles, the spaceships of Cosmic Voyage are represented only in miniaturized form, attended to by tiny figures, as much toys as the interplanetary giants as which they are described. Like Waldner's and Yarmolchuk's inventions, and like Tsiolkovsky's models of rockets, the spaceships of Cosmic Voyage are model objects, the first documented materializations of an imagined but imminent future. Evidently, a Cosmic Voyage was drawing not only on the same construction and design principles as these three experimental technologies, but also on their logic of modeling. Featured in the same newsreel as Yarmolchuk's train was the Nikitchenko brothers' technique for filming special effects, which was deployed in Cosmic Voyage. The action of Cosmic Voyage unfolds amid a scale model of a futuristic Moscow landscape dominated by the unbuilt palace of the Soviets. Actually, my slides are out of order here again. Here is the scientist against this miniature landscape of the future Moscow. And there on the right, we see the future Moscow dominated by the palace of the Soviets. The Nikitchenko method of perspectival foreshortening is used to plot full-size human actors within this model landscape. But the most innovative feature of A Cosmic Voyage is its fluid long-take cinematography, quite distinct from the Nikitchenko method that naturalizes the model's spacecraft. The spacecraft in A Cosmic Voyage are first presented in this remarkable long take of approximately 100 seconds, where the camera tracks along and around the models. As it tracks, the camera catches other vehicles and even human figures in motion, making them part of a dynamic, polycentric world. I apologize, there seems to be a glitch in the track. But there you can see the smaller vehicles moving around, and there we see a couple of human figures also, clearly miniature, shot within this apparently fluid take in what seems to be real time. Thus, A Cosmic Voyage simulates less a verisimilitudinous world than a verisimilitudinous gaze upon the world. That is to say, it operates not by animating the model itself, not only by animating the model itself, but also by animating a subjectivity capable of viewing it. A Cosmic Voyage produces three-dimensional models not only of the things of the new world, but also of its subjects. So my last section is model art. And in closing, I want briefly to return to the image from Andrei Platonov with which I began, for I am reminded of it when I watched the second film in Anton Vidokla's trilogy, The Revolution Was Caused by the Sun, from 2015. Specifically, this film continues the legacy of Soviet cybernetics, which drew on cosmic sources to produce a new theory of modeling, no longer as a material practice, but as a virtual reality. However, Vidokla's film also features suspended machinery that not only represents cosmic revolution, but which is also intended to produce it, following, I have to say, some vague logic and displaying quite dubious results, which we see, for example, in these scenes. Like Cosmic Voyage, I'll add, one of the key scenes at the beginning and the end is shot in a graceful long take from a drone, creating an effect of naturalization and naturalized gaze, as in Cosmic Voyage. Now, Vidokla's model here is deeply rooted in the history of such installations, from Tatlin, I would think, to Francisco Infante Arana's model of space movement infinity from 1963, and even Ilya Kabakov's Palace of Projects from 2000. Kabakov carefully follows the logic of the model in the visitor's movement through the Palace of Projects, three sections, from improving the world and the self to the task of stimulating new projects. Here, cosmism remains primarily an operation of scale. Olafur Eliasson has commented on the way in which we seem to be returning to the model as a way of working through our current predicament. Previously, models were conceived, Eliasson has written, as rationalized stations on the way to a perfect object. Thus, the model was merely an image, a representation of reality without being real itself. What we are witnessing is a shift in the traditional relationship between reality and representations. We no longer progress from model to reality, but from model to model, while acknowledging that both models are in fact real. Models have become co-producers of reality. In light of my presentation, this sounds as if socialist realism has conquered contemporary art. Could this be a good thing? One thing that distinguishes our contemporary model making from that of socialist realism is its irony. Kabakov, in particular, foregrounds the model's history of failure at keeping communism aloft. Project 52 by Ver Stajarov, a retiree from Leningrad, proposes the digging of canals across the entire country, which directly recalls the Soviet abuse of convict labor on canal projects. These projects all represent impossible, self-destructive desires, and Kabakov lampoons any world in which they are held seriously, primarily, of course, the world of Russian and Soviet cosmism, and he ridicules the frankly silly idea that such impossible desires can be achieved by making material-scale models of them. However, when Kabakov provides a material installation of these desires, a model of their fulfillment and their failure, and when Vidokla documents the puzzlement of Karaganda residents over his experimental technologies, the animating desire is allowed to persist despite its impossibility. By installing these models, they provide us with a mode, if not of realizing them as reality, then at least of inhabiting them briefly, experiencing materially the space of the impossible. That is, I want to say, these experiments in revolutionary irony might not model a viable formation of the Anthropocene, but they do help us to model us. They do help to model us as subjects of what will come after. By returning us to emotional as well as logical standpoints, these works reverse Bukharin's privileging of technical over humanitarian communication. In this way, these artists make it possible to imagine soul being put back into the contemporary art machine. Thank you.